It's now 9 o'clock. Okay, thank you guys for coming. I'm going to do some of that quick housekeeping. Cell phones, silence, please. Let's see. Let me do a quick... Well, I'll let you. You want to do it like before introductions? And... Okay. I'll do that. You want to do it before I introduce the panel and title? Well, then why don't you just do that right now? I think that's a great idea.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. Third day of a great conference on world affairs. I'm so impressed you're here. I hope many of you were at the jazz concert last night. Was that, I mean, I just get goosebumps thinking about it. It was so spectacular. I told Brad, I said, okay, Brad, it has to be short. We need to be out of there at 9. And at 10 o'clock, I turned to my husband and I said, it's 9, isn't it? And he said, oh, no, it's 10. But thank goodness, it just flew by. It was such a great event. Anyway, I'm Betsy Hand. I'm the community chair for the Conference on World Affairs for this year. So happy to have been doing that with so many wonderful volunteers who have made this happen and bringing great speakers like you're about to hear today. This is, I don't know why everybody isn't in this room, because this is the room. This is the panel for today. Anyway, there's a lot to choose from. So I'm here to pitch a little bit. The Conference on World Affairs is free, but it costs a lot of money too. So I've been a donor for many, many years and really stepped up this year. And the reason is that I just love the conference. I've been going to the conference for probably 12 years, and I house a speaker every year. And I've loved it ever since I visited CU when my daughter was here. And I would just, every April, I would put my backpack on and put on my sneakers and just spend the week, which I'm sure a lot of you guys are doing today, this week. So, but I want everybody to step up a bit and make a contribution of any size, if you are so inclined, to help us keep CWA thriving. Thanks so much. Enjoy.
All righty. Housekeeping. Today is April 12th. This is a debate titled, A Thriving Economy, Should Government Weigh In or Get Out of the Way? It's panel number 3102. Yeah, you want to memorize that. This is a debate that was reintroduced last year. Some of you may recall that after having been absent for a few decades. It seemed to be a really cool thing, so we redid it. I was glad to get to participate as a moderator of that one last year. Can everybody hear okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's how we're going to do this. We're going to have some introductions, then we're going to have these guys are going to do 3 to 5 minutes just kind of saying what they believe from a economic standpoint about the role of government. We'll then kick it off, and they'll go back and forth 3 minutes each. If one of them is going to go a little long, the other one has the right to give them the permission to do that, and then we'll try to equal out the time. When we get to 15 minutes or so from the end, we will open it up to questions from you guys. We didn't do that last year. In this session, we're going to be I'll read this. That's what they told me to do. In this session, we'll utilize both the CWA app and a note card system, although I'm not sure, did we find any note cards? We found some, so you can utilize the note card system. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and a pencil from our producer, who's in the back, then give your question to the producer. If you're a student, however you're doing it, put the word student at the beginning of your question or on your note card at the beginning, because CWA tradition is we always give preferential treatment to questions from students. It's a learning thing. Hi, I'm Joel Dyer. I'm the editor at Boulder Weekly. I've written a few books. Most of them looked at how the economy impacted certain things. I'm not an economist. These guys are. This is Stephen Moore. Stephen has... My gosh. Well, look, I'm not going to and reintroduce them based off of what's in here because they've got long pedigrees. They've done amazing things. Stephen's been either serving or consulting or advising presidents since Reagan to Trump. I'm guessing he skipped a couple of them in there, just a thought. But, you know, Heritage Foundation, what, Cato, written for everybody, former Wall Street Journal editorial board member, impressive stuff. Over here, we have Marshall Steinbaum. Marshall is from the Roosevelt Institute. he didn't do most of those presidential things. He has worked as an economist, really looking at the role of power and inequality, competitiveness, consolidation, things like that. I think you'll have, it's pretty simple to see where these guys are going to be different. If you look at the question here, you know, are should we weigh in or should we get out of the way? I think we have get out of the way, and I think we have weigh in. You guys have to be behaved. I think everybody tells you that all the time. No clapping when you hear things you like. No hissing or booing when you hear things you don't.
That's no fun.
I know, it takes the time, but we don't. I told you guys last year, I'm a terrible authoritarian. Don't make me be one. I mean, it sounds just like you're going to be in trouble. Please don't do that. I'm terrible at it, so don't make me do it. And we don't want to look like a United flight that's been overbooked. We don't want that lady back there to go hauling you out by your hands because you won't behave. So everybody be on your best behavior, and let's get this thing rolling. We flipped a coin. Stephen's going to go first, and the idea, Stephen, is give me 3 to 5 minutes telling me why you think the government should get out of the way when it comes to the economy. Or if that's not your position, we're in trouble, but go ahead.
It hasn't changed. Hi, everyone. Thank you for inviting me to Boulder. I love the great state of Colorado, and it's very fun to be here. My friend Linda, I just want to do a shout out to Linda Feathers for twisting my arm to come out here, and I'm glad you did because it's great to be among you and with you. So I'll just throw out a few ideas about the economy. Look, I'm a free market guy. I believe that the free enterprise system is the goose that lays the golden eggs. That everything that we have is really a result of the free enterprise system, and it's the reason why one of the reasons why America is rich and so many other countries are poor. And I'll just throw out a couple of ideas. Look, I'm really bullish right now on the U.S. economy. I think we're looking at a possible big renaissance in the U.S. economy as we had in the 1980s and 1990s. And I think this is a good time to be in the stock market. I think it's a good time to be starting a business. We're seeing this in terms of, I think that the November 7th, 2016 was an inflection point. I'm a little biased because I work for Donald Trump and I helped write the economic program. But I think a couple things are going to happen, and I'll just mention a few things that I think are going to be very positive for the economy going forward. Number one, energy. I think we have a potential now to, because we have a president who wants to produce American energy, and because of the most amazing made in America inventions and the ingenuity of that industry, the United States now has more energy resources than any other country in the world. And we can, within 5 years, be the energy super powerhouse of the world. And instead of importing energy for the first time in 50 years, we can be a major exporter of our oil and gas and coal and all of other energy resources, which is a game changer, I think. And by the way, a lot of these technologies started in places like Colorado and Oklahoma and North Dakota and so on. So that's a huge story. It just changes the whole dynamics of the economy. And Trump gets it. He wants to go full speed ahead using American energy. We're talking about maybe 6 million jobs. Second of all, we do need to change the healthcare system. I believe we can use the power of the free enterprise system to, government has screwed up our healthcare system. The two industries in America that have had the highest rate of inflation over the last 50 years are education and healthcare. And what's the same about those two industries? They're the two industries that are most dominated by government. And then you ask a liberal, why is the government involved in education and healthcare? And they say, to make it more affordable. Gee, they've done a great job, haven't they? I mean, you look at what you have to pay for college these days, and healthcare costs are going through the roof. I believe if we move towards a more free enterprise system in healthcare and got government out of the way in healthcare, and I do think, by the way, we're a rich country. We can assure everyone. We can provide health insurance for everyone, but we can do it in a way that uses competition and choice that will dramatically reduce costs. And then taxes. I'll kind of end on this. There's a lot more to talk about, but I'll just throw out this. I think if we can fix our tax system, which is really god-awful, and you mentioned the word competitiveness, and that's what we should be thinking about in Washington every single day. How do we make the United States of America, this great, great, great country of ours, the most competitive country in the world? And we haven't been doing that, frankly, lately. And we have a corporate and business tax system that was written as if it was written by our enemies. You probably couldn't come up with anything stupider than the way we tax our businesses today. I think most of you know, we have the highest tax rate in the world on our businesses, which is highly counterproductive. Many of you have heard the term corporate inversion. These are American companies like Burger King, like Medtronic, like Walgreens, like one of our great drug companies, Pfizer, that are leaving the United States, and they're effectively renouncing their United States citizenship. They're going to Canada, they're going to Ireland, they're going to China, they're going to Mexico. And then we don't have to scratch our head and say, gee, why are they leaving? They're telling us why they're leaving and taking jobs with them. And it's because our tax is so much higher than the rest of the world. So under the Trump plan, we want to take that rate from 40% down to 15 or 20. And I guarantee you do that, and those jobs are coming back to America, no question about it. It's going to be like a magnet effect. And I know I'm so happy to see so many students and young people here. You know, you're concerned about jobs, and we're going to have a lot of jobs if we can get that money back in the United States. I had lunch a couple of weeks ago with Jeff Immelt, who's the CEO of General Electric. General Electric is one of the 10 biggest companies in the world. It's an American company. And I asked Jeff, I said, Jeff, if we cut that corporate tax rate from 40 to, say, 15 or 20%, and then we were to have this repatriation, so we allow companies that have hundreds of billions of dollars overseas, allow them to bring that back to the United States and invest it here, which obviously we want. We want companies investing here, not in Beijing or not in Malaysia and other countries. How much money would General Electric bring back? And he said, Steve, if you do those two things, General Electric will bring back $100 billion. Now, just think about how many jobs that would mean for America if you had $150 billion. Now, some of it might be paid out to shareholders, but you know, most of us in this room own stocks. So I think that the possibility of moving from this slow growth era that we've seen under Bush and Obama to a much higher growth era is very positive. This is a great time to be in America. It's a great time to be entering the job force and a great time to be investing in this country because we're moving more towards a free enterprise, pro-business atmosphere.
You get 5 minutes and 45 seconds.
Great, thank you, and thank you for having me here. I just wanted to start by thanking Mr. Moore here. He played a key role in implementing the tax policy that he just described in the state of Kansas, essentially eliminating corporate taxation, making it possible to recategorize your business as a small business and get out of taxes altogether. Required huge budget cuts, elimination of education, health, infrastructure funding, and you know the Kansas economy has had a very terrible recovery from the Great Recession in comparison to key states. So I wanted to say on behalf of the people of Colorado, thank you to Mr. Moore and go Buffs. We're here today to talk about what makes an economy thrive, whether government should play a role or get out of the way. But to my mind, it's kind of a funny topic to discuss because, to be honest, economists have no idea what causes economic growth. We've certainly tried a lot of the things Mr. Moore just mentioned, and I would say the record over the past 40 years has not been all that great. On the other hand, we do know what causes economic, or at least what conditions have created economic growth in this country's past. We used to have 92% tax rates on the rich in this country. We used to have labor rights protected at the federal level, and including the right to organize and create unions that protected workers from having their jobs outsourced. We used to conduct a trade policy that was actually in favor of free trade and more trade, not in favor of maximizing the size of trade deficits and sharpening the threat of outsourcing that's wielded against American workers to reduce wages. We used to have a federal antitrust policy that was aimed at diffusing economic power far and wide through the supply chain and ensuring equal access to markets for all comers. We used to have public goods, higher education, health care. That the whole point of it was to make sure that there was a strong public option that everyone had access to, regardless of who they were. Those things created the fastest growing decades in this country's history, from 1945 to the 1970s. We had strong economic growth at an aggregate level, and that economic growth was distributed far and wide throughout the income distribution, throughout the geography of this country, and resulted in the fastest rate, the only time essentially in U.S. history since emancipation, that racial earnings gaps and racial employment gaps have been closing. So to my mind, on the one hand, we have economists telling us that, okay, the route to economic growth is to reduce taxes on the rich, to destroy labor unions, to privatize public services, to shift the cost of training workers from employers to would-be employees in the form of students and taking on student debt. All of those things are, you know, sound economics, so to speak. You'll hear them in the fanciest economics departments in this country. You'll hear them from influential policymakers like Mr. Moore here. And you know, that really has not worked out very well for this country. So it's, I think, time to reconsider the wisdom that was lost in the intellectual and ideological revolution that has taken place since the late 1970s, where we lost the concept of public goods. We lost the concept that the point of the tax system is not just to finance important government expenditures, but also to rebalance power. You know, there, as the experience of Kansas shows, if you essentially make it possible to conduct a business without paying taxes at all, what you get is the owners of businesses sucking as much blood out of the economy as they possibly can. And that's bad news for workers, bad news for their competitors, bad news for consumers, as we saw, you know, literally blood sucking with the customer at United Airlines the other day. You know, this is the economy we live in. It's, you know, we're just here for the ride. You know, the top 1%, they're the ones driving the bus. So I think it's fairly clear from U.S. history, you know, where does economic growth come from. I only wish my fellow economists would, you know, pay attention to that empirical reality and stop peddling the false narratives that have been debunked by the last 30 years of experience of slow growth and rising inequality.
Now, hold your applause. Till the end. They pretty much agree on everything. I think if it's okay with you guys, why don't I like make it 4 minutes instead of three, because it's clear that you can't solve the world's problems in three.
Before so, we can.
Absolutely. So we'll go with four. Do you want me to toss a question, or you just want to take that and say what you want about the things that he was saying, which I would prefer so I can just sit
okay.
here?
You know, I'll just make a couple of observations.
All right.
A couple things. I mean, let's talk about Kansas, because I was involved in the Kansas tax cut. Kansas has actually done pretty well with that. In fact, if you look at what's happened with Kansas in terms of jobs and so on, they're doing about as well as any of the Midwestern states. But it's good. Look, I'd love to have a debate about the states. I just wrote a book with my friend Art Laffer called The Wealth of States, and there's no better example of why taxes matter than to look at American states. So one of the most important things that's happening in America today is that every day in America, 1,000 people on net are leaving the kind of blue states that Marshall is talking about, states like New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts and states like my home state of Illinois and Minnesota. And they're moving, and where are they moving? Where are people moving to? They're moving to the red states. They're moving to states like Texas, and they're moving to states like Florida. And so you talk about taxes. You know, what is the highest tax rate today in California and New York? 13.5%. What is the highest tax rate in Texas, Florida, Tennessee, states like that? Zero. Amazing statistic. And Marshall, I love his explanation for this, but in the last 10 years, Texas and Florida, states that have no income tax, and also states that are right to work. I'm not against unions, by the way. I actually think Republicans should really go aggressively after the industrial unions, because I think the Republicans should be the party of the working class, and I don't think the Democrats are anymore. They're too infatuated with issues like climate change. But if you ask why, you know, if you look at right to work, this is just a basic human right, right? That a person, we all believe in the right of association, right? You should have the right to associate, you know, the right of association means you have the right to associate with a group. But the First Amendment also means you have the right not to associate. And forced unionism is just an anti-American idea. Unions should certainly be able to represent anyone they want, but they shouldn't force people to join the union. And that's what happens in half of the states now that's called right to work. And the forced union states, by the way, for every job that's been created in a state that requires with forced union policies, there have been two jobs created in states that are right to work. So there's been a migration of jobs and capital and economic activity and prosperity to the states that are doing the kinds of things that I'm talking about, and they're moving away from the states that Marshall is talking about. The other thing I would just mention is, look, I just certainly hope nobody believes in a 90% tax rate, right? I mean, that would be economic suicide. You want to kill this country, put in place. And Bernie Sanders ran on this deal, 70, 80, 90% tax rates. You wouldn't have virtually any economic activity left in this country. We now live in a global economy where a business or a person, a capital, can move instantaneously across borders. The capital is moving to where it's treated most nicely. We need to be more competitive. We need to get our tax rates down, not to give tax cuts for the rich, but so we can create more jobs and businesses. By the way, the people in the top 1%, two out of every three of them, do you know what they do for a living? They own, operate, or invest in small businesses. How are you going to get more jobs if you don't have the small businesses that have the money to expand? And I know a lot of you in this room, I see a lot of friends, own businesses. Our philosophy, if you give the businesses more money and they have more after-tax profits, what can they do with it? They can hire more workers, they can pay their workers more, they can build more factories. That's good for all workers, not just businesses. And we need an all-inclusiveness. We have to put America first and make sure that we're the most competitive country in the world so we create the kind of high-paying jobs that Marshall and I and all of us want to see in this country. And I'm here to tell you we can do that. I think we're back big time, and I think we could see a decade or two of prosperity if we just put America first and make sure. I'm not saying no government. I'm just saying let's make sure the government isn't impeding in the private sector and getting in the way of growth and higher wage jobs.
That's four.
All right, well, I'm going to respond to that to talk about three things. One is that I agree with Mr. Moore here, that taxes matter a great deal. Second, I want to talk about geographic mobility, because I wrote a paper about that subject last year. And third, I want to talk about entrepreneurship and small businesses. So, you know, as I said, we agree that taxes matter, but the question before us is how they matter. You said 90% tax rate would kill the economy. We've tried it before, and it didn't. And, you know, I would just ask you to look at the empirical evidence as opposed to the sort of theoretical fantasy swirling around economics departments and, you know, look at the experience that we've had. And it wasn't, you know, some historical aberration. Every leading economy had a very high tax rate on the highest earners in those days. Germany had one because we imposed it on them when we were ruling their country, basically, in the late 1940s, and they kept it because it worked well. So this is not some sort of, you know, economic fantasy that would crush all the life out of the economy. And I'll tell you why it would matter. It would matter because it reduces the incentive of the rich to profit at everybody else's expense. There is no reason to merge two giant corporations that are already profitable, lay off 10,000 workers to the benefit of the shareholders and the top managers and the lawyers and the investment bankers and the economists and whoever is consulting with the C-suite on conducting that merger if nobody's going to make any more money from it. The 90% tax rate on the rich, that's a de facto maximum income. And I would say, you know, that is actually the kind of incentive that we want to set up through the tax system. Speaking about business taxes, I think the evidence that is quite clear from the times that we've tried reducing taxes on business. In particular, we ran a tax repatriation holiday in 2004. You know, I personally don't have lunch with Mr. Immelt on a daily basis, but if you look at what happened on in that occasion, yeah, they did bring back hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes, but literally 100% of it went out to shareholders. No effect on investment, no effect on jobs, no effect on wages. All of it was to the benefit of the owners of the companies. The same thing happened when we passed the partial dividend tax cut in 2003. You see a huge increase in payouts to shareholders among the companies that were affected by that policy. No change in investment, no change in payroll, no change in wages, no change in jobs. We have tried the policy that Mr. Moore is advocating we nationalize and take further again and again, and it just doesn't work. And I think that, you know, after decades of hammering away with these theoretically derived tax policies rather than actually looking at the evidence has led us to the point where we are now. And the idea of doubling down after we have the evidence from all of these past times and doing it yet again is, you know, a little bit depressing, especially as, you know, somebody who's looking at most of his career in front of him. And I hope that the students here will, you know, see where they've got to the, or how they've gotten to the place now where it's really hard to get a job even though you're the most skilled generation in this country's history. I wanted to speak about geographic mobility, as you mentioned. The real fact in geographic mobility is not some sort of fantasy of people moving from blue states to red states. The fact is that geographic mobility is at a historic low in this country's history. It's been declining over the same period as the labor market has been declining. The key ingredients in the decline in geographic mobility are essentially that it's hard to find a job anywhere. Nobody's getting wage increases because nobody's getting outside job offers. This is the way that you run a functional labor market, is to have many outside job offers coming in all the time, that's just what we haven't had. If you look at earnings tenure profiles, so the amount of wage increase or the percentage wage increases that you get from staying on an extra year, an extra 2 years at a given job, those are flat relative to in the past. And just the sort of job ladder that is the mechanism by which people gain earnings over their lifetime and ascend to the middle class, that is just broken down, and that is because the labor market's not working.
Well, look, I mean, 1,000 people every day are moving, on net, by the way, on net, Americans are leaving blue states, the states that Marshall say work so well, and they're moving to red states. Now, that's called voting with your feet. People are voluntarily moving from states like New York and California. By the way, California, did you know in the last decade, California, how do you screw up California? Really, how do you screw up California? California is the most beautiful weather, beautiful mountains, beautiful beaches, beautiful women. I mean, what's not to like about California, right? And over the last decade, for the first time in American history, 1.5 million people, more, 1.5 million more people left California than came to California. Why is that? Because they have the most liberal policies, all the policies that Marshall is talking about. Now, where did they go? Texas, Florida, Tennessee, states like that that are free market oriented. I think this is probably one of the most powerful pieces of evidence, the voting with their feet phenomenon. By the way, 1,000 people a day is 4 million people a year. It's 40 million people a decade. That's not a big migration? Sure it is. And that's why these states like New York and New Jersey and Connecticut are really hurting. On the 90% tax rate, I mean, Marshall, you know this. We had a 90% tax rate, but nobody paid it. Nobody paid. I don't know if there are people in this room old enough to remember what happened back then. But when you had a 90% tax rate, there were so many loopholes in the tax system, nobody paid the 90% tax rate. Now, here's an amazing thing. We went from, and by the way, the guy who cut the income tax from 90%, anybody know who that was? John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy, a Democrat, who said, and I can quote him verbatim, "Is a paradoxical truth that tax rates are too high today and tax revenues are too low. And the soundest way to raise the revenues in the long run is to cut the rates now." Is that beautiful or what? And by the way, was that wasn't Ronald Reagan, that wasn't Donald Trump, that was John F. Kennedy, a Democrat, who believed that when you cut tax rate, you would increase investment, and so on. Boy, did it happen. The three decades of the last 100 years where we've had the fastest rate of economic growth were the 1920s, the 1960s, and the 1980s. All three of those periods were preceded by very, very large reductions in tax rates. Now, by the way, one last point about this. If you compare the share of income taxes paid by the richest 1% today versus back in the 1960s when we had a 90% tax rate, back in the 1960s, the top 1% paid about 18% of all income taxes at a 90% rate. Today, at a 40% rate, well less than half of what it was, the top 1% pay 40% of the income tax. By the way, how many of you knew that? The richest 1% pay 40% of the income tax. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And to say that it's not a very progressive, the top 1% pay more than the bottom 97%. That's a pretty amazing statistic. What that's telling you, by the way, is we need more rich people, right? We need people to get richer and richer. One last thing. Why is it a bad thing if companies pay out dividends? I mean, we're all shareholders, right? Or we all should be.
You know, in fact, what I would do is I would turn Social Security, which is the biggest ripoff for low-income people, let every young person in this room take 10% of their paycheck, and instead of sending it to Social Security, let them put it into an IRA account where they can own stocks, so, Marshall, they can be the owners in these companies too. So every person in the United States of America can be a capitalist owner. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? You want to talk about sharing the wealth and a rising tide lifting all boats? Let's have every single American worker own the companies that they work for. And we can do that by putting Social Security money instead of the black hole of Social Security, which, by the way, for young people in this room, the worst investment that you will ever make in your lifetime is Social Security. You're going to get a negative rate of return on it. You'd be better taking that money and putting it under a mattress. What I'm saying is you can earn a 6, 7, 8% rate of return on that money, and every young person in this room under that system would retire with $1 million.
All right, drag them out of here.
All right, well, I guess, I have to say, speaking for people of the younger generation, we are definitely not all shareholders. I think, the bottom 50% of the wealth distribution own 0% of the wealth, and, that is not going to change anytime soon. So the idea that giving out money to shareholders is neutral in the economy is, not exactly consistent with the facts. I mean, the other thing to mention is that the statistic that rich people pay the highest percentage of federal tax revenue is completely misleading. That's because they are earning a higher percentage of all of the income than they ever have before. If you actually look at how different people are burdened by taxation, which is actually the definition of tax progressivity, you're going to see that rich people are burdened less by taxation now than at any time since the income tax was enacted. And that it gets to exactly the issue with what you said about how nobody paid the 90% tax rate. That's what I'm saying. That's great. You want nobody paying the 90% tax rate because you want a de facto maximum income. That is what creates a egalitarian income distribution in this country. I don't agree that the loopholes in the system were anywhere near the level that they are now.
So is that 100% you want?
No, what I'm saying is that you want a system that the rich can't wriggle out of, and you can't wriggle out of it by putting your winnings in tax havens. You know, I tell people, if you're wondering where your job went or where your wage increase went in the last 30 years, you should read the Panama Papers, because that's where they are. They're in the tax havens. And the idea that this policy of basically you said it yourself, making things nice for the owners of capital, that benefits the rest of us has just been disproven time and time again by every economic policy that we have enacted in this country, especially the tax breaks for the owners of capital and for shareholders and so on. It's just a fantasy, and it has nothing to do with economic reality, and it really is time that we start making economic policy on the basis of actually observable reality. I want to come back to two other points, both of which have to do with competition policy. You mentioned that healthcare has had an enormous inflation relative to the rest of the economy. That we know for a fact why that is. It is because of market concentration among both providers and insurers. There was a great paper that came out last year about where exactly there's high percentage increases in healthcare costs and high dispersion. It's in hospital markets that are concentrated, and that is the result of lax antitrust policy. I mean, this is one area in where the federal government has been relatively more active than in other industries just in recent years, basically in the second half of the Obama administration, fought tooth and nail by both the insurance lobby and the provider lobby and the hospitals. It's essentially impossible to win an antitrust case nowadays in federal court because of the unfavorable judicial precedents that have been established by the Chicago School and the sort of intellectual revolution that kind of bypassed Congress to influence things behind the scenes. The Obama administration put a ton of resources into winning those cases, and they did, but really that is preventing the ratchet from turning at the same rate as it had been turning. If we want to dial back the ratchet, if we want to make those markets competitive and reduce prices for consumers and make it actually that you can get healthcare at a decent rate in this country, we're going to need an antitrust revolution and something like a public option for health insurance that really put consumers first and aren't all about allowing the providers and the owners of those companies to profit at everybody else's expense.
I'd like to formally lodge a complaint against whoever scheduled this for 50 minutes. In order to get to the questions, we're going to have to do a conclusion now. Darn it. So 3 to 5 minutes to kind of sum up and take a look back to the original title on this.
What was that again?
Yeah, it's called economics. The idea of explain to me how, what we need to do to have the government get out of the way. What will help the government to get out of the way? And I'll ask you to describe what process we can go through to, you know, get the government to weigh in. Or you can talk about whatever you want because it's fascinating.
I'm a libertarian, so I just talk whatever. Look, I think we've found some agreement here. I'm against monopolies. I agree with Marshall that there is way too much concentration in the hospitals today. I hate the health insurance companies. By the way, the health insurance companies were the ones who sold us out in the river on Obamacare. Did you know that? All the health insurance were all in on Obamacare because they realized they were the ones who were going to get rich on it. So the health insurance companies have gotten very rich on health on Obamacare, and the rest of us have suffered. And I agree, there's way too much concentration in hospitals today. I'm really worried about that. I think we need more competition. One of the things we want to do with Obamacare, Republicans don't talk about this enough. I mean, how can anybody be against interstate competition for health care? I mean, why? I live in Virginia. I have an Ohio auto policy, and why is it that living in Virginia I can only buy a Virginia health insurance policy? You know, what you're exactly right about market concentration being potentially a bad thing. Today in America, because of Obamacare, 1 in 3 Americans live in a county where there's only one health insurance company. So what kind of competition is that? It's like, you know, Henry Ford used to say, you can buy my Model T in any color you want as long as it's black, right? I mean, there just isn't any competition whatsoever in the health insurance market today. That's why the costs keep skyrocketing. That's why I just got back from Arizona 2 weeks ago. In Arizona, middle-class families under Obamacare are facing thousands and thousands of dollars of increase in their health insurance premiums. Gee, I thought that was supposed to save $2,500 a year, but you know, a lot of people are dropping their insurance. So the other thing is, yeah, absolutely, monopolies are horrible things. Can we please get rid of the Postal Service and let anybody deliver a letter they want to? Can we please get rid of a government school system that is a monopoly? I mean, what in the world is wrong with just giving every parent a $10,000 voucher and letting their kids go to any school that they want to? I mean, it's obvious, right? Get rid of the public school monopoly and let kids go to Catholic schools, Jewish schools, Montessori schools. You know, I'm from Washington, D.C. It's probably the single greatest tragedy in America is the state of our public schools. I think most of you would agree. I mean, the kids, if you saw the public schools in Washington, D.C., it would bring tears to your eyes. No one is learning anything. And by the way, we spent $20,000 per student in the public school system in Washington, D.C. $20,000 per school. And we have the highest dropout rates. We have terrible math and reading scores. You can get a better education in the Catholic school system in Washington, D.C. for half of the cost. So let's get rid of that monopoly. Monopolies are bad things. I completely agree with that. We believe in the free market system that creates competition. Competition is what lowers costs. We see that in the computer industry. We see it in every other industry, except the ones that are either operated by or regulated by government.
All right. Well, I guess I'll close by also talking about the free market because, I think the free market has actually done a fantastic job of spreading the wealth and ensuring employment and wage increases for everyone. The problem is that we just haven't actually done what's necessary to keep it going in the last 40 years. The rate of entrepreneurship, for instance, is low because nobody can find a job, so they have to stay with the jobs that they have. Starting a small business is risky, and if you don't think you're going to be able to get your job back because even having a job is a privilege, you're not going to go and do it. That's what we found when we looked at both the declining entrepreneurship and declining geographic mobility. That is a failure of the so-called free market economic policy that said, you know, running the labor market at full employment is not a matter of federal policy anymore. That used to be something, it used to be considered a policy failure if somebody didn't have a job, if somebody didn't have wage increases over the course of their careers, and we have sort of transformed into this ideology where anything like that becomes, the victim gets blamed. that it's their fault, they don't have the right skills, they weren't in the right place. You know, you get this sort of litany of excuses for what is a failure of policymakers and of so-called economic experts to actually make the economy work for everyone who lives in it. On the matter of privatization and public goods, you know, I think that, first of all, I completely disagree that you would tears would come to your eyes if you saw the D.C. public school system. It's actually improved a great deal in the last 10 years. Secondly, you know, the problems that we have with higher education, especially that's what I study, but I think that same is true in K-12, really is about undermining strong public goods in favor of a misguided privatization agenda that says, you know, you have to be one of the right people living in the right place in order to get a good education, and, you know, that's all on you. The idea of having a free and equal, high-quality public education, public services in general, has just been completely eroded. And I think that lies behind a lot of people's loss of faith in government. I mean, they expect to be screwed over by United Airlines and other private industry. You know, government is there to make the economy work for everybody, and you know that is exactly what has been lost in the intellectual revolution that we all have to live under.
All right. Now you can applaud. This is good. I would have applauded too if I had this in my lap. Okay, we've got a lot of questions. If we run a little bit over, there's nothing happening in here, but you guys don't think that I'm necessarily going to get you to your next place on time. These guys have agreed that we could, you know, take a couple extra questions, go a little bit long, so I don't want to make you late. So watch your own clock if you have to be somewhere else really quickly. We'll start with a student question. Some of these are directed at these guys individually, some are not. When they're not, I'm just going to let them both take a crack at it. This is from a student, and if you want to like stand up when I read your question so people know how bright you are, that's okay. It feels kind of faceless to do it this way. This one is, in regards to New York's progress in free college, how do you think free college would affect economics? Should free college be provided from an economic standpoint? And I'll flip a coin. Go ahead, Stephen.
I think the greatest financial scam in America, I think everybody in this room would agree with me, the single greatest scam in America is how much universities and colleges are costing and charging our middle-class families. It is outrageous. What college, I don't know what costs here at Boulder. I have two sons. One of my sons goes to Northwestern, $62,500 a year all in. That's stealing. That's cheating. We have to have a much more, you know, you've got the average tenured professor now. I mean, look, there may be some professors in this room, but it's ridiculous. The average tenured professor is teaching 5 hours a week in front of students. It's a scam. And we've got to get, we as Americans, you know what I'd love to see is the Colorado legislature should start looking under the hood and seeing how this college is spending its money. And every college in the state, in my home state of Virginia, the biggest increase in prices has been in tuition costs. It's outrageous. I mean, you can get, one of the things that's going to bring this down, by the way, is online education. Because you can take these courses now at 1/100th of the cost, and hopefully that will bring down costs. But we need to start, and by the way, you know, everybody says, keep increasing the amount of the student aid. We do that year after year after year. More and more student aid to the students to pay for colleges to make it more affordable. What do you think the colleges do when we increase the student aid? They raise their tuitions. So it's like a dog chasing its tail. Every college in America today should cost half of what it costs today. And that should be our goal. We should all work together. How can we get rid of the waste and inefficiency and extravagant spending in universities and make sure that these are affordable? Because it's ripping off middle-class families. I mean, how could you, if you have a middle-class family with an income of $50,000, let's say, how in the world can you put two kids in college? You just can't do it. And we've got to be really focused on bringing those costs down. And pumping more and more money into the universities isn't the solution. We need to, I think, here's an area where we really do need to get the government out of the way and make these universities be responsive to the taxpayers and the students, because they're not right now. And it's bankrupting American families. The very middle-class families Marshall and I were talking about, you know, that have been suffered so much, they can't afford to send their kids to college because of this big ripoff.
Well, the problem with higher education is not that the costs are going up to individuals. It's that the spending by the states is going down. I mean, this has nothing to do with fraud or abuse or whatever highly paid tenured professors. This is because we decided to stop supporting public higher education through state funding and instead shifted the burden to individuals and their families, and also to third-party sort of ideologically motivated funders who kind of take the opportunity of higher education becoming this, eroded edifice and kind of come in and say, okay, well, you know, we'll give you a big grant for this university provided you create the centers that we say and teach what we say. And the idea that, you know, an ideological witch hunt from the state legislature is going to be the solution to higher education's problems going forward is, totally out of touch with reality, I would say. As to the free college as an idea in general and the New York legislation in particular, what I say about higher education is that it's acting as a toll booth to the middle class by making the labor market not work the way it's supposed to. We have essentially shifted the costs of getting a job to the individual, so you got to buy more education in order to get through the toll booth. And free college is a great way of basically taking the toll booth away, but we also have to make sure that the road leads somewhere. That's not the only solution. As to the New York legislation, I think it's essentially good. The one provision that I'm very concerned about is that you get your grants turned into loans if you leave the state. I think, you know, that our labor policy in general, and I include higher education and student debt in labor policy because I think that's exactly what it is. The expansion of the federal student loan system is the most high-profile, largest labor market policy in this country in the last 10 years or so. We have done it in a way that says, you know, you only benefit from this if you do X, Y, and Z. That is, we condition it on the idea that the beneficiaries should conform to some sort of behavior that is determined from on high, in this case by the state legislature. And the fact is, if you leave the state of New York because you get a job offer elsewhere or you have to go care for a sick family member elsewhere, you should not have your grants turned into loans. I think that is just a way of taking away with one hand what you've given with the other. I'm supportive of free college, and I think it is absolute. I mean, the one thing I would say about this is that what's completely missing from that legislation is any hope of desegregating the public higher education sector. Higher education as a whole is very segregated. The state sector is segregated least, but even so, there's a lot of segregation within it. And what I say we need within the state sector is a Brown v. Board of Education for higher ed.
Do you want like 30 seconds to say anything about that, or just go into the next question?
I actually think free college is a really horrible idea. I really do. I think, one of the things that I found in a lot of my studies about, look, we all want to see a rising middle class. We want income mobility in this country. We want people who, the American dream, if you grow up poor, you can get rich in this country. And one of the most important things, because this is for the young people in this room, the most important thing you can do when you're in your teens and your young 20s, work. Get a job. Get a job. And, it's so clear that when you get a job, for college, the idea that 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds shouldn't have to pay for their own education, ridiculous. They can get a job and they can help pay for it. And you know what? If they get a job and they actually have to pay for the education, they're going to value it much more. Right, they're going to put money, and I know this just from, this is just a personal anecdote. I remember I lived in my senior year in college, I lived with five other guys. And, three of them were just, a free ride, it was free college for them, and the other three were working. They had to work 20 or 30 hours a week and go to class, and they didn't party all the time because they didn't have time to do it. But the three that worked while they were getting their education, those are the ones that succeeded. And the three that just, was a free thing, it was the next thing to do. So there's a real value. And in economics, you don't want to disassociate the person who gets the service from the person who pays for the service, right? That's the whole problem with so many of these areas, like healthcare today, is that we've disassociated the pricing system. And so I think it's better. One other just quick thing on the United thing. I agree with you. I mean, what happened, I think we all agree, what happened on that United flight was absolutely horrifying. And shame on United for doing that. But there is a free market solution by my mentor, Julian Simon, who came up with the solution 40 years ago. But because the airlines are regulated by the FAA, and the FAA sets the rules,
What all you have to do, the solution to what happened on the United flight was obvious, right? All they had to do was say, who's willing to, for $800 to get off this flight? And people said no. Who's willing to get off the flight for have an auction? Who's willing to get off the flight for $1,000? Who's willing to get off the flight for $1,500, $2,000? Just keep going up. You know, there's a price for everything, right? And then you would have what we call a Pareto optimal solution. Everybody would have been better off because somebody would have gotten maybe $1,500 to get off the flight and take a flight the next day, and you wouldn't have had to have this person dragged off the flight against their will. So let's use the free market and overbooking, and that'll solve that problem too.
They just saved them $260 million.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it comes out of United.
Yeah. This is a student question also. And it's for Stephen. You mentioned cutting business taxes to stimulate the economy. What is your plan to make up the tax revenue lost by these cuts?
You want Marshall to go first?
No, it was to you. This one says Stephen.
Look, we need a tax cut. This country needs a tax cut. I just wrote a big piece on this for the Wall Street Journal. First of all, I do believe that the corporate tax is so high that we're losing so many businesses that I believe we're on the wrong side of what's called the Laffer curve. That is to say, I actually believe, this will be an experiment. We're going to cut the rate and we'll see whether it turns out. I actually believe we can get more revenues at a lower tax rate because you're going to see so many businesses coming back. Look, businesses don't want to leave the United States. I mean, this is the best place in the world to do business in. You have to really try to get businesses to leave for China or Mexico or Ireland or these other places. So part of my solution is just let's get that rate down to about 20%. By the way, at 20%, we'll be at the international average. You know, all these other countries, you know, like even the socialist countries like Sweden have a lower business tax rate than we do. I mean, how crazy is that? So I think we get a lot more business activity. And by the way, we're going to create a lot more jobs. And if it costs some revenues to get more jobs, jobs are what people want. You know, Marshall's right about this. We're not creating the kinds of jobs we used to in this country. And it's because businesses are leaving. And my old boss, Dick Armey, used to say this so well. And it's profoundly true. You know, liberals love jobs, but they hate employers. You know, you can't have one without the employer. Without an employer, you don't have a job. And we've got to treat our employers like the... small businesses are the backbone of the American economy. Let's reward them, not punish them.
Republicans like their employers.
Well, I mean, we've been trying that for 40 years. You know, we've been trying to make things as nice as possible for employers for 40 years, and, you know, they've taken the money, put it in their pocket, and said, yeah, can I please have another tax cut? You know, the idea that we're going to – so first of all, on corporate taxes, you know, we have two big, big problems in the corporate tax – in the federal corporate tax system. Or one is that corporations are offshoring profits, putting those in tax havens, not paying taxes on them. The other is that corporations are offshoring jobs, putting jobs where they don't have to pay workers anything and pocketing the money from that and putting it in their tax havens. So these are not the same problem, and cutting taxes for corporations is not going to solve either of those problems. All it's going to do is further exacerbate the shareholders sucking money out of the corporations they run and putting those in their own tax-sheltered savings accounts or you know, handing them as inheritances or investing them in the professors that they buy and so on. You know, the solution to both of those problems is actually to reverse the economic policy paradigm that we've been operating under, to raise taxes on corporations so that they will invest. I mean, there's actually some very interesting new research papers about basically asking why are corporations not investing the way that economic theory predicts that they should. And the answer is they're basically accruing money on their balance sheets. Their profits are higher than they've ever been. They just sort of sit on the money, put it in the tax havens, grows and grows, expecting a tax repatriation holiday like we had in 2004 when they bring it back to this country and give it to their shareholders. And we are about, if Mr. Moore here gets his way, we're about to just basically wash, rinse, repeat that entire cycle in 2017. So what we want to do if we're going to have corporations investing is actually increase the competitive pressure on corporations. You don't invest, some new corporation is going to come in and take all your market share because they actually did do some R&D. The problem now is that antitrust policy is so weak, the corporations know they face no competitive threat. So why not, you know, take the phone call from the chief shareholder, and when he says, you know, can I get a dividend, please declare a gigantic stock buyback, you know, the CEO said, you know, yes, sir. And, you know, in many cases, that CEO is the largest shareholder. So it's not surprising that, you know, that's the interest that they care about.
Somebody, we're working overtime now, in case anyone had to be in another deal, 9:54. Somebody has Google out there. They said population growth for California 2010 to 2016 was 5+%. New York was 2%. Why do your statistics say that those populations are shrinking? I guess that's for you.
Well, just to clarify one quick thing. When I was talking about those population numbers, yeah, California is actually still growing in terms of population. You know why? Because of immigration. So what I was talking about is internal migration. Where are Americans, what state are they moving to and from? So it is true that California still has population growth, but it's immigration. But once the immigrants come to the United States, or the native-born Californians, they move out. They move out of New York. And boy, everywhere I go. But here in Colorado, I mean, you all know Californians have left that state. I mean, this is one of the big migrations out there. So I just wanted to clarify that point. I wasn't talking about immigration.
All right. I'll throw this one over your way, Marshall. A recent study has shown that increased availability of federal housing subsidies causes rents to rise, making affordable housing less affordable. How do we keep government involved in services without making these services more difficult to provide?
The short version of that is I strongly believe in public goods as a competitive force in many sectors, including in housing. So, we have essentially moved to a model where any kind of social welfare is in the form of subsidies, and those tend to, you basically have to spend the money on housing. So, of course, that's going to increase demand for housing, and in an environment in which the supply is constrained, that's going to drive up the prices. What that says to me is that rather than give people a subsidy to buy or rent houses themselves, we should just, go back to the model that we know works really well, which is public goods that compete with private providers, and that drives prices down. And I think that is quite applicable in the case of healthcare and higher education, transportation, for instance, as well as in housing.
You want to start?
I have a strong opinion on
that. All right. Don't know if you have a strong opinion on any of this stuff here. How will the looming public pension crisis impact the U.S.? Anybody want to?
Yeah, I'll take that. So I totally do not buy the general narrative that we have a looming public pension crisis. First of all, Social Security is solvent. It is a complete myth that it is not solvent, and in fact, it would be a very good policy to expand Social Security for the era of precarious labor market attachment, and where, frankly, very few people have any money in their IRAs. I mean, and 401ks. It's interesting to me that on the one hand, we have huge accumulation of wealth in tax sheltered savings accounts like 401ks and IRAs, and on the other hand, nobody has any money in these things. And what that says is wealth inequality is being driven by these what I call social policy tax shelters that don't work as social policy because they don't provide, in this case, a secure retirement. And they don't work as tax policy because all they're doing is giving a tax shelter to people who would have saved the money anyway. Now they just don't have to pay taxes on it. I want to speak for a second on state pension crisis, where you also hear this rhetoric bandied about. Relative to the rules for essentially determining the solvency of private sector pensions, state pensions are in fantastic shape, and in fact, it has been a strategy of sort of right-wing policymaking at the state level to require that they be overfunded as a way of sucking money out of other programs that they want to kill. So it is just not true that state pensions are underfunded. If anything, if your state faces a budget crisis, the pecking order of which creditor gets paid off first is where to look. I mean, the norm has been that the claims of the bondholders are the ones that have to be serviced, and we're going to cut public services in order to service those. To my view, if you're really concerned about state public pensions, those people, they worked for the wage that got paid into the pension, and you're saying 30 years later, you got to take a wage cut relative to the work that you already performed because we can't pay this out anymore. Why should we prefer the bondholder as creditor to the state pensioner?
Wow.
I'm from Illinois, so I know a little something about pension deficits. And wow, it's Illinois is a tragic situation right now. So is California, by the way. To say that these states don't have a pension crisis, wow. I mean, Illinois, what's happening in Illinois, if they stay on the same course they're on over just for the next 10 years, 10 years from now, one out of every four tax dollars in the state of Illinois is going to go for a retired pensioner. That means you're not getting roads, you're not getting highways, you're not getting schools, you're not getting anything. And by the way, pensions, the amount of the pensions are ridiculous. I mean, you've got people who can retire with $80,000, $100,000 pensions, and they can retire at the age of 55. So the public pension system is out of control. It's bankrupting states, in my opinion. I see it right now in Illinois. Illinois doesn't have a budget today. They haven't had a budget for 18 months because the teachers unions are the strongest force there. So I'm really worried about it. By the way, one of the things piece of advice I give to those of you who are investors in the room, buying these municipal bonds and thinking that you're going to get repaid, look at the size of these pension problems, not just in states, but in cities. I wouldn't think it would be such a bad thing, by the way, if some of these states and cities actually just defaulted on these debts. And then, people wouldn't be so eager to put money into the financing the pension systems. What I would favor is just, look, on Social Security, I said, the idea of Social Security is just give young people, let them put 10% into an IRA account and let them accumulate interest. The average young person today, if over 45 years, because the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest, right? If they start putting money into an IRA account at the age of 20 and they accumulate the number for 45 years, the average young person is going to get a higher benefit than they would from Social Security, and they would be able to leave $1 million to their kids. So we're really ripping off young people with Social Security. I think it's probably the worst program in the budget for young people, because those are the people who aren't going to get the benefits that they were promised. And look, I mean, how can you say the system isn't going bankrupt? Just look at the Social Security trustees report. Their own actuaries say that they're going to run out of money in 20 years. Social Security is already running a deficit, by the way. We're actually spending more out of Social Security than the payroll tax is collecting. So, Marshall, I just don't understand. Are you saying the actuaries are lying, or?
Well, no. I mean, we have a trust fund because we recognize that the baby boomers were going to retire and claim more in Social Security. So everything you're saying and treating as some sort of, policy failure is, in fact, something that was baked into the cake 30 or 40 years ago. And, the policy is working.
But where's the money going to come from to pay the benefits? I mean,
There's no money in the trust fund? About Treasury bonds?
What does the government own in the trust fund? What does the government have in the trust fund?
Trillions of dollars.
Bonds. The federal government owns bonds. So the federal government owns money.
Okay, so here, to those of you in the audience who are investors, if you own any Treasury bonds, pay attention to the fact that Donald Trump's economic advisor just told you that that money is worthless.
I'm not saying it's worthless. I'm just saying, where's the money going to come from to pay off the bonds?
I mean, this is the government finances its deficits with taxes, and in the case of Social Security, it has a dedicated tax revenue in the form of a payroll tax.
But it's not going to collect enough.
If in 30 years there's a deficit left after the baby boomers have all retired and the trust fund is exhausted, as was designed in the first place, then we can solve that problem by raising the payroll cap
again?
By a few thousand dollars a year. This is a completely manufactured crisis, and I think in adjudicating this, it reveals a lot of the policy inconsistencies that are at the heart of the last 40 years of economic policymaking. I mean, you sort of engineer a crisis, stop collecting taxes, then declare that there's a gigantic federal budget problem and we can't afford all of these obligations, and so we got to cut them. That is the classic star of the beast. We heard whatever his name is, Norquist, talk about this for decades. And we're living in the country they created. I mean, if you like the 30 years of wage stagnation, even as workers are more productive than they've ever been, if you like rising inequality, if you like the lowest entrepreneurship levels in this country's history, massive student debt. I mean, all of this is part and parcel of the exact same package of economic policies that, you're basically saying, yeah, this has worked great. Let's do this some more.
Well, just one thing on that. I mean, look, we just had the biggest pro-big government policies in the history of this country under Barack Obama, right? We had an $800 billion stimulus plan. We borrowed $10 trillion. We had the Fed flood the economy with cheap money. We had three minimum wage increases. We had tax increases on the rich. Everything that Marshall is endorsing, we've done. We did that in spades in the last 8 years, and it gave us the weakest recovery since the end of World War II. You know, and that's the reason Trump won the election, is because the policies that you're talking about that Barack Obama put in place didn't resonate in places like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa. I was out on the campaign trail. I went to these places, and I saw what was happening in these towns across America. And you're right. The last 15 years, and I would add the Bush years to this, have been a disaster. But by the way, the 80s and 90s were unbelievably prosperous years. I mean, we saw about a 30% increase in middle class wages and compensation, which in 20 years, the 30% increase is a big increase. Marshall, you keep saying, like, oh, the economy, you know, it was great until the 1980s. How many of you in this room are old enough to remember 20% mortgage interest rates under Jimmy Carter and 15% inflation? The economy sucked in the 1970s. I'm older than Marshall is, but that was the worst period for the U.S. economy since the Great Depression. So why do you keep saying that somehow 1980 was the turning point? The worst period was the 1970s when you had shrinking wages, higher inflation, double-digit
wages in the 1970s. That is a statement that is completely predicated.
It is not.
Being
the average middle class real wages for the middle class went down in the 1970s faster than any other decade. And the reason, because he had 15% inflation. So even if you got a 10% pay raise, at a 15% inflation rate, you're losing money. There were famous stories about the UAW getting 8% annual increases in their union contracts, and they lost money because of inflation. So it simply isn't true that somehow, I mean, do you want to go back to the glory days in the 1970s?
God forbid? I want to go back to the glory days when we actually had labor unions and 92% marginal tax rates.
Hang on. We're like...
One more question, then we go.
No, we got to go. We're already like almost 20 minutes over. What's amazing, if you think about it, these guys look at the same information, right? And what does that tell you? It tells you that the solution is out there. Because it's when you vote. That's when you decide whose statistics you care about and whose you believe. So this has been a phenomenal panel.
Yeah.